Hi everyone, Tamarack here, and this is the Diamond Path. This week, we're going to deal with something that's specifically Buddhist. It's called the Six Paramitas. Now, having said that it's specifically Buddhist, the title is certainly specifically Buddhist, but you'll see the six are pretty much covering a lot of everyday life type stuff. So there's not going to be anything here that you're not familiar with. Let's begin by the defining paramita, the six paramitas. What is paramita? It's loosely defined as perfection. The actual definition is more like that which has reached the other shore. That's an allusion to passing from regular, everyday thinking to awakened thinking, enlightened thinking. There's a lot of references in the Buddhist sutras and commentary about going to the other shore, crossing over, that kind of stuff. So the paramitas are perfecting, well, be perfecting these next six things. So when we're talking perfection here, and let me explain that a little better. The bodhisattva, you've heard me use that term before, but of course I'll redefine it. A bodhisattva is someone who has made an effort, is making an effort to become awakened, to get to that other shore. And a bodhisattva does that awakening process, so not for oneself, though certainly one benefits, but for the benefit of others. I've said that many times. So a bodhisattva is someone who's on the path of awakening, but the whole path and all their efforts are dedicated to helping others awaken and making life better for everybody. So the six paramitas, let me list them first so we have an idea what we're talking about, and then we'll take it from there. The six paramitas are generosity, morality, patience, energy or vigor, and then meditation and wisdom. Obviously, the first four are in common usage in everyday language: generosity, morality, patience, and energy or vigor. Meditation and wisdom, perhaps more of a spiritual tilt to it, but these are concepts we all understand. There's nothing terribly mysterious here. But when I call them, and from what they are known by as the perfections, we're talking about what the bodhisattva does in their journey. These are things that they do, these are things that many of us do, but the concept of perfection means that just that. We're striving to actually be perfect in each of these. I remember giving this talk at Sangha one night, and somebody said, well, you don't mean perfect, you mean, you know, nobody's perfect, you mean pretty good. And I said, well, no, actually the six perfections mean just that, because the journey that we take winds up at a place of perfection. If awakening, true awakening and complete awakening is anything, it is a sense of perfection. So these perfections are meant to be understood that way, but obviously most of us on the journey are still working on it. So let's start with generosity. Now, generosity means giving, obviously, but it means giving in many ways, both material and spiritual. When one gives, one could give money, you know, millions and millions of dollars that are given each year for various causes is a form of generosity, certainly. Giving of one's time as a volunteer is another form of generosity. Giving one's time to listen to other people's problems, to be their friend, to be supportive, all of that works its way into it. Little note on giving money. If we're thinking in terms of perfection, money is fine and certainly helps a lot of causes, but in truth, some people who would otherwise have a pretty good life and have a little extra money often, sometimes, I should not say often, sometimes use money as the vehicle of their generosity, when in truth it's quite easy just to sit down and write a check for $20 and send it to your charity, and they feel a little better because of that, and the charity feels a little better because of that, and I do not mean to take away from that. But in terms of perfection of generosity, time put in and true endeavor put in probably trumps money. Only because you're not just involving the paycheck and a few moments of your time and licking the stamp and that sort of thing, but you're actually investing yourself, truly investing yourself in the process. So it's a generosity of self. So in generosity, compassion is once again a big word. We're not doing this for our own benefit, so the generosity is expressed in our compassion for others. And as I've said many times, just recognizing the problems of the world and feeling for those that are suffering is not true compassion. That's more empathy than compassion. True compassion means we get off our duff and actually do something to help out. And there's an aspect of compassion, aspect of generosity that I think is pretty interesting and very important when it comes to the perfections. Because in true generosity, there is a selflessness in giving. In other words, the concept that I am giving to you kind of falls by the wayside. The giver and the receiver both are benefiting from this act. And if one takes oneself out of the equation, then the act itself becomes the important part. One receives, one gives, but there's no recognition by either to make that generosity perfect. It's just an act of compassion that has consequences that benefit someone and eases suffering. There should be no ego involved. In other words, one doesn't think like, wow, I really did a good thing by helping that person out and they're glowing all day long. Now, these kinds of benefits of feeling good about what one has done for others, there's nothing wrong with it. But once again, it's not the perfection implied in these paramitas. Certainly most of us, when we do a good deed, are aware that we've done a good deed and feel good about it. But we just have to recognize that that feeling is somewhat immaterial. It's the actual giving that makes the generosity a perfection. Another aspect of generosity, and one that's very easy for us to do, kind of falls under the heading of loving kindness. Just smiling at someone who looks like they need a little help. Kind of a pat on the back or an attaboy to somebody. Recognizing that someone else is standing in front of you instead of, you know, numbly walking past them or taking change from them and hardly looking up. I know so often we'll be going through a line at a supermarket or something and the young clerk in the back is a little too involved in themselves and barely looks up, certainly no hello. And maybe our first inclination is just to kind of ignore them at least, if not feel a little negative about that because they're just not paying attention. You know, they're not being deferential. They're not, you know, they're being a little rude. When in truth, a smile or a thank you or something like that is an aspect of generosity that will benefit them. And as in turn, can make one feel better. And so the whole process, again, of generosity works both ways. Second paramita is the paramita of morality, also called discipline. Now, this is basic ethics, the way we treat others and the way we talk about them. Certainly nothing Buddhist about this, but in our goal of becoming perfect in these six, ethics becomes almost sacrosanct. In other words, we don't treat it as, yeah, I know I should be nicer, I know I shouldn't have said that, and I know I shouldn't have picked that up because it wasn't really mine. In the perfections, ethics become paramount. It's the way we actually relate to the rest of the world. And a good way of explaining these is to list the 10 good actions. Now, every one of these is going to be, almost every one of these is going to be familiar to everyone, of course, but, and they're very simple, they're very basic, they're easy to understand, and they're, you know, not far from everyday life and most religions. But once again, we're talking about the perfections here, the six paramitas. So in our striving to become complete human beings, enlightened human beings, we take these very seriously and we try to perfect them. So we'll start out with a few obvious ones, like not killing. That's one of the 10 good deeds, not killing. I think we can all rally around that one. Not stealing. The third is not committing illicit sexual behavior. Now, footnote is in order here. In Buddhism, and I've said this on a previous talk about sex and passion on the Buddhist path, or whatever it was called, Buddhism doesn't look at any of these sexual practices as deviant in and of themselves. So in other words, homosexuality or fetishes or even S&M or any of these kinds of things are not inherently bad unless someone suffers. And that's kind of the bottom line when it comes to what is and what isn't illicit sexual behavior. If you have two willing partners, then it's a good action. If someone comes away from that situation suffering or losing something, then that's not a good action. So not committing illicit sexual behavior. Fourth is not lying. Fifth is not using harsh words. And I think we all know what that is, but you can imagine, oh, this one-upmanship game that especially young men in high school love to play. I suffered immeasurably from that because I wouldn't do it back to them, you know, like, hey, your mother's this, your mother's that, bonehead, name-calling. And that's a major problem in school, name-calling. So using harsh words towards others just increases enmity, increases fear, and it's certainly not a good action if you use them. Number six is not using words that cause enmity. That's where we're inciting others to hate and be violent, inciting one group against another group. That's all about divisiveness and not about inclusion. Now, I just want to, oh, and then number seven is not engaging in idle gossip. There's a basic rule that many Buddhists use. If you're talking about someone who's not in the room, never express it in a way that you wouldn't have expressed it if they were in the room. In other words, if you have something to say about someone and they were sitting right there, you would phrase it totally different than you might if they weren't. It's a good practice to talk about someone with a little compassion. I mean, we know we wouldn't be talking about a person who wasn't in the room. Excuse me, if the person was in the room, there just wouldn't be the same type of talking going on about that person. But if they're not in the room, the same rule should apply. And it is, once again, just showing this aspect of some understanding and compassion for the person and not to try to divide and take advantage of that other person because you have someone who may be listening and may or may not think it's cool, but there's something that you want to say about them and it's coming out so negatively that you're denigrating the other person. So not engaging in idle gossip. Now, before I get to 8, 9, and 10, I'd like to point out that numbers 4, 5, 6, and 7 all have to do with speaking, the mouth. Body, speech, and mind is a big part of Buddhism. That's pretty much all we are. We're a body, we have a mind, and then our communication between us is the speech. So virtually 90% or more of the actions that one does that can get into another's head or get into another's feelings, get into another emotions, comes from the mouth. I mean, yes, we can steal and lie, so maybe 90%, excuse me, steal and kill, so maybe 90% is high. But in the case of most of our interactions, the harm we cause is from our speech. So we consider speech a very important aspect of good action. So those four are ways to actually increase the happiness and increase the friendship, if you will, between people and not go toward the side with enmity and that sort of thing. Number eight is not being greedy. That's pretty obvious. If you're perfecting your ethics, certainly grabbing something for yourself is a very ego-based, self-centered thing. So greed is not appropriate. Not living in anger. And of course, that's two or three lectures right there. Anger increases all the bad things and decreases all the good things. Buddha once said that anger is like trying to hit someone with a hot coal. First you have to hold it and then you throw it at them, and of course you get burned as bad as they do. So anger is far from a perfection. It's one of the biggest problems human beings have. And the tenth is not having false views. This is where it swings a little bit more to the Buddhist idea. Believing in impermanence, or rather, let me phrase it in the negative way, not believing in permanence, whether it's anything or anybody, not believing in a substantial self, an essence of self. I don't mean our everyday self. We're obviously here. We have ourselves. But in the Buddhist context, self and ego are not only inappropriate, they don't agree with the true nature of reality. And then, of course, the Four Noble Truths and many of the other Buddhist dharmas or truths, that life is suffering, that we can escape suffering, and then the way to escape suffering is through the Eightfold Noble Path. So in other words, having a false view is having a view that we are us, they are them, I need for my own, because the self and the ego is very important, everything's about me, that life is about trying to grasp something so it's permanent with us and we're happy with it, when in truth, everything is fleeting and there is no permanent self, and that there is no distinction between each other. So in other words, not having false views is having views contrary to the truths that Buddhism has expounded over the years. The third perfection is patience. Now, patience with what? Obviously other people. But we should also recognize that one of the strongest aspects of perfecting our patience is to be patient with ourselves. It's very difficult to have either patience for yourself or love for yourself or generosity for yourself. And then if you have it for yourself, that's the first step. If you do not have it for yourself, it's awfully difficult to apply it to others. So having patience with yourself, both in your practice and in your everyday life, and trying to follow the ethics of the second perfection, having that patience with yourself on the path as you're learning some of these very difficult Buddhist teachings. The teaching on emptiness I've been struggling with as long as I've been a Buddhist, and I understand it intellectually, but I'm not probably getting it nearly as deep as I should. So one has to be patient when learning and trying to internalize these things, because it's not easy. Some of this stuff is very difficult. But of course, the main aspect of patience is having patience with others. When we look at others and we understand that they are who they are because of causes and conditions that came before them, and so they're at this point, and they may be acting very unskillfully, But this is where this patience comes in. We can see that they are acting in an odd, angry, greedy way, but that we've been there ourselves. By understanding that we got to this point, and we know how we got there, we understand what, when our buttons get pushed, what it means. So we have to realize, too, that all other beings act in the same way. They're not inherently necessarily angry or inherently contrary or inherently want something that you've got. But they've come to this with certain needs set up by conditions. So we look at a person as to who they are now and understand that all of us have come to where we are now through a process that has formed us. So as we recognize it in ourselves, we have patience with others for this very same reason. Patience in the understanding that there's certain conditions caused these people to be who they are right now. And then thing about patience, too, it really aids in the conquest of hate and anger. If we're patient with ourselves, then our anger can often be minimized. It's sort of like the old count to 10 type thing. If you take those few moments, if you pause, if you have patience to let this emotion come in and then transform itself into something not as angry, not as ugly, then we can assuage this anger in ourselves. And if we have patience with others and understand where they came from, then hating them becomes a lot more difficult. If we understand where they're coming from, hate almost it just becomes inappropriate. So having patience works across the board for a lot of our emotional baggage. The fourth of the six perfections is energy, or vigor. And this is resolute effort. Now, once again, if we're on the Buddhist path, and of course this works for anything, if we're on any path, but we're talking Buddhism here, it's not easy. We have to try to maintain a regular practice. We have to curb our tongue. We have to check our greed at the door. We have to be careful about our anger. So in order to perfect all of these things, we need to have some energy. We need to have some strength. And so we use this, we perfect this vigor, this energy, to allow us to actually accomplish these things. And the fifth one now is meditation. Now this is a major tool. Once again, meditation is mind looking at mind. We're recognizing why we do things. So as we sit in meditation, the other perfections, the generosity, the morality, the patience, all of these things come up in our own mind as our own conflicts, and we recognize them in ourselves. So meditation becomes this tool for recognizing it in ourselves and in others. And then, of course, perfection of meditation means perfection of concentration. After all, that's the bottom line with meditation, is the ability to focus the mind, stilling all other thoughts and focusing on one thing, which is usually the breath in practice. But in life, you're focusing on the conversation you're having with someone without letting what you're going to say leap in before they've finished what they're saying. If you're doing a job with your hands, you have to craft something, you have to do something, you have to fix something. The more focus and concentration we have on that, the better it gets done. So meditation is a tool not only for understanding our mind, but the major tool for concentration. And the sixth one is perfection of wisdom. This is kind of the culmination of the other five. And wisdom is pretty much what we think of when we think of wisdom. It's the supreme knowledge of not only all the teachings, but all of life. This is the big nutshell, folks. You know, we've spent a lifetime learning not just the mundane, everyday things, but the important things, how we relate to each other, the clarity of vision we have with life, discerning what is real, a knowledge of all the factors of life and beyond. So it's a culmination of the other paramitas and a culmination of all our practices, whatever they may be. We sit in this wisdom that we've gained from speaking and acting properly and compassionately. So, as I said, these are called the six perfections. Again, generosity, morality, patience, energy, meditation, and wisdom. We all have them to a degree or another. Some of us have maybe one down pat and are really pretty lack on the other ones. Others of us have no clue, perhaps, how to approach these, and others who've been on the path for a long time may be reaching that state of perfection. There's enlightened people at all times on the earth. It's not just a Buddha now and then every millennia or two. There's people walking around today that are enlightened and have these six perfections down. So when we say perfections, we shouldn't be made cautious by that word. Perfection is like the ultimate ability to apply these. But the practice of trying to apply these and the practice of doing these things is a perfection in itself. There's a culmination of them, which is a perfection, but using that energy, that vigor, to practice them is a perfect way of getting a good life. In other words, if we did these perfections, or just tried these perfections, whether we reach them or not, if we try to reach them, our life will improve. Well, let me finish with something that we do in our service. It's from the Heart Sutra. We do in our service every week. It's a Sanskrit chant, and this is back to the definition of paramita, that which reaches the other shore. It's gate gate para gate parasam gate bodhisvaha. Gone, gone, gone beyond, gone way beyond. Enlightened mind, so be it. Or, amen. So this is a chant that we do every week. It's something we do take to heart. It is, after all, the Heart Sutra. And it's about reaching that other shore, about getting out of our normal everyday thinking and our normal everyday acting, and really trying to perfect ourselves. And why do we do it? For others. Well, until next week, been a good little talk. We'll see you next Sunday morning at 8:30, or if you choose, on Monday afternoons between 1 and 1:30. So until that time, thanks for listening. This is Tamarack Garlow of Higashi Tendai Buddhist Sangha in Great Barrington. Have a peaceful week, and do it perfectly.